You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Nick Bryant was a senior correspondent for the BBC. His books include When America Stopped Being Great, A History of the Present, The Bystander, John F. Kennedy and the Struggle for Black Equality, Confessions from a Correspondent Land, and The Rise and Fall of Australia, How a Great Nation Lost Its Way. He has a doctorate in American history from Oxford. And his new book is The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself. Thank you for joining me, Nick.
Rick, it's such a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me on.
As I read this book, I couldn't help but think again and again of an old saw, which is that those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. And this book made me think that those who read revised history are inclined to repeat it. And this book is about the repeated history of American division, which begins with the Constitution itself. Explain how the Constitution set up our divided nation from the get-go.
Well, Rick, victory over the British brought you independence, but it didn't bring you an instant sense of nationhood. And in those early years after the Battle of Yorktown, you know, there was a fear that there would not be a United States of America, that the country would split into three or four different confederations along regional lines. So you'd have a kind of a version of America in New England, you'd have a version of America in the South, you'd have a version of America around New York. But they did manage to come together at the Constitutional Conference, obviously, the convention in Philadelphia. And they did manage to hammer out a constitution that became a kind of operating manual. But in many ways, of course, the constitution was an agreement to keep on disagreeing. And a lot of the issues that bedeviled America back then bedevil it now. I mean, race was the big one, of course. They reached this compromise over enslavement, but that compromise ruptured, of course, in the years leading up to the Civil War. They came up with arrangements about how power should be divided between Congress and the presidency and the judiciary. But again, America's still arguing over that. They came up with an arrangement how power should be divided between the federal government and the states. But again, that is an area of modern day contention as well. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, America really didn't have a sense of national consciousness until about 50 years. You know, Virginians saw themselves as Virginians. New Englanders saw themselves as New Englanders rather than Americans. And it is, like so much of American history, that history tends to get forgotten. So when you're looking at the kind of deep divide in America right now, the chronic polarization between the red and the blue states, it's always worth remembering that division has been the default setting.
You know, one of the things I really love about this book is the way you start at a subject in the present and then burrow back into the past. Talk about just creating the structure for this book and deciding to delve into the history of our division.
Yeah, I really wanted it to be a mix of genres. I want it to be very personal. And at the start of this conversation, I should tell you that I have a deep love of America. I always felt more comfortable in America than I did in my homeland, which is Britain. I arrived in California as a 16-year-old on the eve of the Los Angeles Olympics, and I was just blown away by what I saw. I witnessed that extraordinary opening ceremony, that rocket man coming into the arena. It struck me back then that America was the only sort of country that could pull off a stunt like that. I love the Hollywood panache of all those grand pianos hammering out Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. I absolutely fell in love with the place. So I wanted to bring in a lot of personal memoir. I wanted to bring in a lot of reportage. I covered the Trump years for the BBC. I covered the Obama years and the Clinton years and the Bush years. and the beginning of the Barney years for the BBC. So I wanted to bring in a lot of reportage from that. And I wanted also to bring in the sort of scholarly side. You know, as you said in the introduction, I did do this doctorate in American history. That took me from my middle year to MIT, actually. I was a visiting scholar there in Boston. And I wanted to bring all these things together. So, and I also thought, I wanted to kind of write a 250-year history of America, but not in a sort of chronological way. As you know, I've done it in a thematic way. So there's a chapter on the strange career of American democracy. There's a chapter, which seems very timely at the moment, of course, on political violence and the long history of political violence. There's a chapter on race. There's a chapter on guns. There's a chapter on division. There's a chapter on abortion. So that's how I've set it out. And it's this mix of personal memoir, reportage, and a lot of history, and a lot of history, frankly, that I wanted to kind of revive, because it's that history that is often forgotten or misremembered or deliberately concealed that makes more sense of the rise of Donald Trump.
You know, we're here after what are called the eight most important days in recent American history. And one of the things that reading this book you realize is that this, what we are experiencing now, has been the default setting, as you put it, since the beginning of this nation. And it interests me, too. You talk about, you know, the gun law, like, in, for example, in Pennsylvania, 8 days ago or 9 days ago, 10 days ago, somebody tried to kill Donald Trump in Pennsylvania using an AR-15. Pennsylvania is an open carry state where it's absolutely legal for you to walk around with guns hanging off of your belt. Talk about the history and our understanding of the Second Amendment. This is an absolutely gobsmacking chapter in this book because it's not what everybody thinks it was.
Yeah, well, the great triumph of the NRA after the last 50 years is to turn and transform the meaning of the Second Amendment. It was always intended to apply to militias. It was always intended to be a collective right. The Founding Fathers did not intend the Second Amendment to be the basis of individual gun ownership. And that is the meaning that has become attached to it now. But it's only very recently, Rick, as you know, that that has happened. It was only in 2008, in a landmark ruling called the Heller ruling, that the Supreme Court actually said the Second Amendment applied to individual gun rights. Right throughout history, the Supreme Court had rejected that idea. It had always said it is a collective right. And the idea was that states should have militias as a protection against the tyranny of the federal government. It wasn't supposed to be about the right of individuals to bear arms. As one famous American historian put it, you don't bear arms against a rabbit. I mean, this wasn't to do with hunters. It was to do with militias. And if you look at the Third Amendment as well, that too was all about militias. But what happened over the years is that the NRA mounted this campaign with enormous success in the end to get the Supreme Court to actually have their individualist interpretation of the Second Amendment. So it's a fraudulent interpretation. It is an interpretation that is not founded in history, but it's the interpretation now, which is the law of the land. And it's the basis of not just individual gun rights, but also a lot of mass shootings and horrific gun slayings that we see play out so regularly in America right now.
You write really well about the mass shootings, which really affected you permanently, personally, and I understand that. So talk about being a reporter from the BBC from a country where guns are not ubiquitous, in a country where guns are ubiquitous.
Yeah, this was the most depressing aspect of all about covering modern America for the BBC, the number of mass shootings that I ended up covering. And Rick, if you were asked me now to write a chronology of the mass shootings, I could not do it. I would have to Google it to get the timeline in my mind. Now, in Britain, where I grew up, there was a terrible mass shooting called Dunblane. There was one of them. And immediately afterwards, there was serious gun reform that prevented that from happening again. Where I'm speaking to you from now, which is Australia, there was a terrible gun shooting in Tasmania. And again, very stringent gun laws were brought in that stopped it happening again. I can cite exactly Dunblane. I can cite Port Arthur. But if you were to ask me to list all the American mass shootings that I've covered, I just simply couldn't do it because they just all kind of merged into one. And what my wife and I always said was that we would leave America when our kids realized and reached the age when they understood why they were hiding under their desks, pulling down the blinds, turning off the lights, locking the doors of their school in New York City, which of course are the kind of rehearsals that every American school kid does now. And that they did reach that point. They did understand that it wasn't a hurricane which they were preparing for, which is what the school told them. It was actually a hail of bullets. And we thought that was the right time to leave America. So, I left a country that I deeply love, partly because of this worry that was always in the back of your mind about the possibility that, your kids could be the victims of a mass shooting, because mass shootings happen on every day, in every town, in every community. We lived in a pretty affluent part of New York City. We lived in a place called Dumbo. It's right next to Brooklyn Bridge. But even while we were there, there were 73 shootings within a kind of mile radius of where we lived. And an awful lot of those were fatal. And, we never heard the sound of gunfire. We never saw bloodshed. But, we lived in that kind of setting. And that is the setting that a lot of Americans live in today. And we just didn't think that was a good environment to raise our kids. So we ended up leaving America. So, gun violence actually persuaded us in the end that America wasn't a great proposition to raise a young family in.
One of the things about this book is that when one reads it, there are so many things that are happening right in the here and now that it just immediately applies to and gives you a whole new vision of it. And let me give you an example. This morning I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about Kamala Harris and her trying to choose a VP candidate, and somebody mentioned J.D. Vance and how he had gone from comparing Trump to Hitler to comparing him to Abraham Lincoln. And I'm thinking, well, if Trump read this book and learned the truth about Abraham Lincoln, he'd be even more dangerous.
That's a history that is often forgotten, that many of the heroes of the American story actually displayed some authoritarian tendencies. Abraham Lincoln was a classic example of that. To save the Union, he broke the Constitution. Many regarded him as a kind of American dictator during the years of the American Civil War. He suspended habeas corpus. He shut down more than 300 newspapers that were critical of the Union. He trampled all over the First Amendment right to free speech. Some people were imprisoned simply because they sang Confederate songs. And yet, Abraham Lincoln, of course, has never been toppled from his historical throne of grace. Americans were willing to countenance that kind of authoritarian leadership in these kind of situations. FDR was another classic example. In the 1930s, he was assailed for being an American dictator. You'll remember he tried to pack the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court tried to thwart the passage of the legislation of the New Deal. But the American people supported FDR. He broke the unwritten rule, of course, that you only serve 2 terms of president. But, crucially, the American people kept on re-electing him. And one of the lines from his inaugural address in 1933 is often forgotten, but Eleanor Roosevelt reckoned it got the biggest applause line. And it was where FDR suggested that he might have to alter the balance of the Constitution, that he might have to take up wartime powers in peacetime because the Great Depression was biting so hard and that he would need emergency powers in an extraordinary time. And yet again, the Americans were willing to countenance that. there has always been an authoritarian strain in American life, and there has always been a willingness of American voters to put up with it and support it and even welcome it. So when you're looking at Trump as a sort of putative dictator, it's always worth remembering that in history, American voters have been prepared to support that kind of presidency.
And the setup of the Constitution itself was friendly to that, because it was somewhat deliberately vague, and it was only the gentlemanly tendencies of Washington that helped to limit that. But of course, Washington himself was a slaveholder and very problematic.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. The presidency was fashioned very much with George Washington in mind. And there was a sense that the general who surrendered his sword at the end of the American Revolution would be circumspect with how he wielded his presidential powers. And that did turn out to be the case. There was this sense that Washington would be his own check and balance. Now, you know, the founding fathers realized that Washington wouldn't serve in perpetuity, although people like Alexander Hamilton hoped that he would. He'd become a kind of elected monarch. But they did put in other safeguards, but there weren't that many safeguards put in place, to be honest. And the specific powers of the presidency weren't spelled out that specifically. You know, the view was very much in George Washington, we trust. And, you know, he didn't abuse his powers, but the Constitution created a situation where others could. And, you know, one of the fascinating things, you know, looking in America right now is how, you know, the Supreme Court and the question of presidential immunity, you know, the Constitution doesn't really say much about that. So you've got a situation right now where the Supreme Court is basically sort of writing the Constitution. And, you know, in a lot of areas during the Trump years, we realized that the American system had really been based on norms rather than laws. And this operating manual, the Constitution, has big gaps in it. And those are the kind of gaps that Donald Trump could exploit.
As a, you know, a stranger in a strange land, as it were, could you talk about seeing, you know, the years of Clinton and Bush were and Obama, or I think the back and forth was there, and there were problems, but they were, you know, that was general. To see somebody like Trump come into power, talk about how that felt to you, because you had the perspective of both an insider and an outsider.
Yeah. Oh, look, I remember the night that Trump won. I was with Hillary Clinton that night, or supposed to be with her, at that convention center in Manhattan, where they put the stage underneath that glass ceiling that she was figuratively supposed to smash, of course, by becoming the first female president in American history. And I was in a crowded press room. There must have been 300, 400 journalists in there. And Rick, it was an unbelievable setting. I mean, we were faced with the biggest political upset of our lives, the most exciting political story of our lives. And yet the mood was very quiet. It was almost funereal. And I think that people who were paid to speak and people who were paid to write just could not come up with the words to describe what we were looking at and watching. And of course, there was this terrible sense that we were all in the wrong place and we'd all got the election wrong. If we'd have got it right, of course, we wouldn't have been with Hillary Clinton. We'd have been over at the Hilton Hotel, which is where Donald Trump had hired a pretty small ballroom because he didn't expect to win. So it was shocking, but on reflection, you know, I wondered if it was really that surprising. I thought that we should have seen Trump coming, because he was the result of a number of trend lines that sort of culminated with his success. I mean, one of them was an economic trend line. I mean, when Donald Trump said the American dream is dead, so many Americans believed him, because they just did not believe that their kids would lead more abundant lives than they did. They didn't think that there would be this intergenerational progress economically, which is the basis of the American dream, and the opportunities were denied to them that had existed for their parents. You know, the political direction of travel in the Republican Party, they'd basically become the anti-Obama party during his presidency. So it shouldn't have come as no surprise that they picked as their presidential nominee the most emphatically anti-Obama candidate. I mean, we trotted out the cliche that Trump had mounted this hostile takeover of the Republican Party. But frankly, Rick, there was an awful lot of shareholder buy-in from the grassroots and rank and file. A lot of his supporters, not all of them by any means, but a lot of his supporters had problems with the idea of a black man in the White House. So again, it made sense for them to pick a presidential nominee who had been the untitled leader of the birther movement, somebody who had questioned the very legitimacy of a black presidency in the first place. I mean, culturally, what were we watching on TV? Reality TV. Who was the star of that? Donald Trump. Technologically, he had in his hands these tools that he could bypass the media. Not that he needed to in the end, but he could bypass the media with things like Twitter and Facebook. Facebook also created the possibility of foreign interference from players like Vladimir Putin, who were keen to see Donald Trump emerge as the president. So when you add in all those factors and add in an electoral college, a mechanism of electing your president where the person who gets the most votes doesn't always win, you've got a situation in which Donald Trump can pull off a victory that seems shocking on the night. But if you look at the kind of history leading up to it, doesn't seem that surprising after all.
And you do look at that history. That's one of the most fascinating parts of this book. In each part of this book, you look at the history of where the things that we right now really like to think that we're in a unique time, that all of everything that's happening is completely new. And this stuff has been with us since the foundation of the Republic, including those kind of upsets where somebody won a minority of the popular vote but managed to get in by virtue of the Congress. So talk about that. There was at least one time when the Republican Congress, the House of Representatives, put in place a Republican president because they were able to do so.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that happened after the Civil War and the disputed election of 1876. It happened before, actually, as well, when Donald Trump's great hero, Andrew Jackson, in the 1824 election, he won the popular vote. But through kind of nefarious sort of congressional sort of back deals, his rival, who was seen as a great product of the Washington establishment, John Quincy Adams, ended up as president. And for Andrew Jackson, this became a great moment of grievance for him, he had this sense that he'd been cheated out of the election in the same way that Donald Trump felt cheated out of the election in 2020. Now, Andrew Jackson had a point. Donald Trump's claim was obviously totally fraudulent. But yeah, there was this compromise in 1876 and it was a terrible compromise. There was a deal that made Rutherford B. Hayes the president, but the Faustian bargain was that if he became president, then he wouldn't enforce civil rights in the South after the Civil War, where emancipated slaves have actually won these freedoms for the first time. And that set the scene and paved the way for the era of Jim Crow. And, you know, again, you know, going back to where we started, which is this idea of a sort of fragile national unity. Well, the price of national unity to begin with was enslavement. And the price of national unity after the end of the Civil War was segregation. And it wasn't until 1965 that actually America achieved what could be truly called universal suffrage with the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which finally allowed Americans, African Americans in the South, to vote unhindered. And what happened immediately after that? Well, a new assault on democracy begins. So, you know, again, all of this stuff, we've seen it before and we've seen it play out before.
I really like the memoir aspects of the book because it adds a kind of a real feel of putting the reader in the midst of all this history. So talk about your experience of the 1992 campaign, which was the first one you got to report on.
Yeah, that was Bill Clinton up against George Herbert Walker Bush. And what was also interesting about that campaign, of course, was the emergence of these proto-Trumps. You know, one of them was Ross Perot, this billionaire who decided to run for the presidency as an independent. And he really, you know, historically speaking, did extraordinarily well. I mean, he was leading in the polls at one stage against Bush and Clinton, and no independent candidate had ever led in the national polls before. Even after he suspended his campaign and then came back, he still achieved a very high percentage of the vote. So that suggested that America was willing to countenance a political outsider, especially a billionaire businessman coming in and disrupting the whole process, which is obviously what happened again when Donald Trump came along. What we also saw in 1992 was the emergence of a Republican nativist candidate, Pat Buchanan, who actually won the New Hampshire primary against George Herbert Walker Bush. It was one of those sort of wounding moments for Bush that he never really recovered from. And he used the slogan, Make America Great Again. He traveled down to the southern border because he thought there was chaos at the southern border and that immigration was this huge problem. He became a real culture wars warrior. He gave a speech at the Republican convention. It was famously said was better in the original German. I mean, he was really quite far right. And again, you know, he was a proto-Trump. He foreshadowed the rise of Donald Trump. So, you know, that was very interesting about 1992. And what was also interesting, Rick, was, you know, I remember Clinton just being scandal-ridden. You know, he faced the problem of the accusations of draft dodging. And there was that affair that was revealed with Jennifer Flowers, this waitress from Arkansas. But Clinton there really provided the playbook that Donald Trump would use to survive scandal in his moment of peril, which was when the Access Hollywood tape came out. Clinton turned what was then called the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which we should have called the Bill Clinton scandal. He reframed the question. It was not who do you believe, it's whose side are you on? And he made it a partisan issue. And he basically said to the American people, and the Democrats in particular, who do you want to win here? Do you want my Republican tormentors to win, or do you want us to win? And he made it a partisan issue. And in the same way Donald Trump has done when he was faced with Access Hollywood, when he was faced with his indictments, when he was faced with his conviction, he isn't arguing the rights or wrongs of the case so much as saying, I'm being victimized here. Do you want my tormentors to win? So there was a lot to unpack in 1992. And there's a lot in 1992, which again, makes more sense of Donald Trump and his ability to survive scandal.
And that is, in a nutshell, the power of this book. And I think it's interesting, too, that for me, at least, it really helped to read the book as opposed to listen to it. Because as you, read the words, you actually have to engage with your brain and understanding the meaning, and as you do that, it brings back, you know, the rest of what you said. It's a much more intellectually engaging process, and so I like you to talk about just the import of being able to read, which is not one of the strengths of the current Republican candidate for president.
Well, I speak in the book about how, you know, a country that has so much unresolved history. And one of the arguments of the book is that one of the reasons why America is so divided is because so much history is unresolved. And it faces this problem of what I call chronic historical overload. You know, you can't reach a point of unity because there is so much history that still divides you. And it's never been sorted out. Consensus has never been reached on all this. And so history has become absolutely vital in all sorts of debates. You know, as we were talking about, the gun debate revolves on an interpretation of history. You know, so much of the debate around race requires an understanding of America's racial history. So much of the argument about arguing over the rules of democracy, you need to understand the strange career of American democracy. It hasn't been... It's no surprise that it isn't in particularly good health at the moment, because really throughout history, it hasn't been in particularly good health. And the problem is that at this moment when America is wallowing in so much history, there's an awful lot of historical illiteracy. And if you look at some of the studies that's done of sort of high school students and their understanding of history, it's not good. You know, if you look at Donald Trump, he's got a really flawed sense of history. He was surprised to find out, for instance, that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. There's that famous moment when he thought that the black abolitionist Frederick Douglass, he seemed to suggest he was still alive. I think Andrew Jackson, who he regards as his kind of presidential soulmate, and he visited his sort of plantation down in Tennessee pretty early in his presidency and declared himself to be a great fan. Well, in all honesty, I don't think he knew a great deal about Andrew Jackson before he became president and decided to put his portrait in the Oval Office. So you've got this situation where America is divided by its history, and history animates so many contemporary political debates. But at the same time, there is this historical illiteracy and also, crucially, this historical blindness. I mean, one of the arguments of the book, really the main argument, is that Donald Trump is as much a product of history as Abraham Lincoln or FDR or JFK or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama or Joe Biden. It's just the history that is forgotten, misremembered, or deliberately concealed.
Donald Trump was recently the victim of an assassination attempt, and I think one of the lines that you wrote that's really important here is, by focusing on the psychiatric state of the assassins, however, we have not always delved sufficiently deep into the psyche of the nation. And I think that this is incredibly important thought, especially with regards to the fact that this attempt happened in a state where there's an open carry law, and also that the as far so far at least there appears to be no real animus against Donald Trump in particular on the part of the assassin, that he was just the guy with the gun who wanted to shoot it.
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, after this kind of event, you want to find out the motivations of the person who was involved. And, we did that in 1981 with Ronald Reagan. It turned out that John Hinckley was obsessed with Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver. And of course, one of the narrative lines in the movie Taxi Driver, starring Robert De Niro, was this assassination attempt on somebody running for the presidency. And, the assassin that tried to take out Theodore Roosevelt, he said he was inspired by the ghost of William McKinley. And again, the focus is on the kind of psyche of the would-be assassin. The same with Lee Harvey Oswald. But I do make that point that it's also worth looking at the psyche of the nation. And LBJ decided to try and do that. Lyndon Baines Johnson, at the end of the 1960s, it was a particularly violent decade. You hadn't only seen the assassination of John F. Kennedy, you'd seen the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, George Rockwell, who was the leader of the American Nazi Party, he was killed. Malcolm X was killed. And at the end of that violent decade, Lyndon Johnson embarked on a quest for understanding. And he appointed a panel of scholars to try and figure out why America was exceptionally violent. And they came up with some really interesting findings. I mean, racism, they said, had always been at the heart of a lot of political violence, the lynching campaigns that you saw in the South, the racist pogroms that you often saw. They said that vigilante justice, there was a tradition of that as America moved westward, the displacement of Native Americans and Mexicans from their land relied often on a vigilante sense of justice. They also said something which was really interesting, which was there was an idea of legitimized violence, that because America was founded after a revolution, that it had a revolutionary ideology that was linked with violent means. And you saw that on January the 6th. I mean, a lot of the insurrectionists were shouting 1776 because they regarded themselves as patriots acting in the spirit of the revolution rather than seditionists acting on behalf simply of Donald Trump. And this panel came up with the idea that the notion of legitimized violence had taken hold as well. But what they also said, and I think this is particularly interesting and germane, is that historical amnesia was a part of this as well. And Americans tended to erase the bits of the history that they didn't really like. And it was this idea that violence sort of contradicted the idea that America was the sort of chosen land, that it was the new Jerusalem. And so what they essentially said was that a positive sense of American exceptionalism blinded Americans to the negative sense of exceptionalism, how they had become unusually violent and how politics often was far more violent than in other advanced nations.
At one point, you write, and I think this is an important idea, that history has become hyphenated. What do you mean by that? And I'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the chapters is about the history of American history. And it's a kind of historiographical look at how in the early days, a lot of the historians tried to create the sense of nationhood by, again, sort of ignoring the bits that contradicted that and giving a sense that America sort of had a sense of, hey presto, instant nationhood, which it didn't. And in the aftermath of the war, there was a consensus school of American history that sort of suggested America were united around certain values, which was, you know, there was some truth in that. And it created a sort of more consensual notion of American history that became popular, especially during the Cold War, as America had this common enemy, and the Cold War had a kind of unifying effect on politics, especially. There was a lot of patriotic bipartisanship in the years after the Second World War. But what you got around the time of the Civil Rights Revolution and the Feminist Revolution and the Cultural Revolution was a reassessment of American history. And that's where you got a lot of the hyphenated versions of American history. So you get an African-American history, you get a feminist history, you get an Italian history, and you get things like Black History Month and Italian History Month and LGBT History Month and things like that. And this idea of a consensual history starts fraying and breaking apart. And you get a lot of the history wars of the 1990s. And of course, the history wars flare again during the Trump years. You know, Trump commissions this report, the 1776 report, which comes back with giving America a clean bill of health on race. You know, it says basically the founding fathers, you know, slavery wasn't a big problem, even though many of them were slaveholders. And that report is obviously designed as a rebuttal to the New York Times 1619 project, which places African Americans far more centrally in the American story. And so that's where you get this hyphenated history, and it becomes binary in many ways. You know, you've got a situation now where, are you 1776 report, where you see American history as glorious, or are you 1619 project, where you see American history as deeply problematic, and you sense the need in modern day society to atone for a past that isn't good?
One of the things that's happened, at least in my lifetime, is that America has become divorced from facts. When I was a kid growing up, I could go home and on any of the three news channels, I could see different footage of the Vietnam War. But it was always the same war, and the reports, whether you were hearing Walter Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley or Peter James, they were all giving pretty much the same story, and we all understood the same set of facts. But in recent years, all of that has just become splintered, and we are living in a new era of post-truth. I talk about previous eras of post-truth because, again, things that we think are new are actually rather old.
Yeah, I mean, you know, conspiratorialism goes back to the Pilgrim Fathers. I mean, they literally arrived on American land believing that the devil would conspire against them. During the American War of Independence, George III was painted as an antichrist. Alexander Hamilton was seen as heading up a kind of cabal of Jewish financiers. Again, that kind of anti-Semitic conspiratorialism, which has often been a continual thread of the story. I'm always struck by the fact that in 1963, you know, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, that created a kind of new sense of conspiratorialism as well. I mean, when the Warren Commission came out and said that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole gunman, then, you know, if you look at the polling, that was when a lot of faith in government started being seriously diminished. But even before that, and I talk about this at the beginning of the book, you know, John F. Kennedy, on the day that he was assassinated, was due to deliver a speech. And we've got the transcript of that speech where he was going to warn against conspiratorialism. And the danger of listening to people who were trying to distort reality. He literally used the term misinformation, which is a term that sort of feels quite modern, but it wasn't. And there was a very famous essay that was published in 1964 called The Paranoid Style in American Politics, which was written by this brilliant scholar, Richard Hofstadter, that warned against America becoming dominated by uncommonly angry minds, as he put it, and warned against this conspiratorialism, an apocalyptic conspiratorialism taking hold. And he actually delivered the kind of forerunner of that essay literally the day before Kennedy was killed during a lecture at Oxford University, where he was a scholar at the time. So, you know, again, all this kind of misinformation is old hat in many ways. It's just that we've got new ways of disseminating it. And of course, the big bang on that, of course, was the invention of the internet, a device originally that a lot of people thought would be utopian and bring Americans together. And you'd all have these civic spaces where you come and discuss things online in a very civil manner. Well, it didn't happen like that. And instead, the internet has become this super spreader of misinformation and conspiracies.
Yeah, instead of a super spreader of the truth, I was there at the beginning when it formed, working for a company that distributed stock quotes over the predecessor of the internet. And you know, as it came, as the internet itself came into being, you know, some of the first people who were talking about this saying, this will be, you know, make truth universal instead of, as it happened, lies.
Yeah, it's amazing to read some of the commentary around 2000, because it really is, excuse me, it really is so utopian that it's going to refresh and revive and energize democracy. You know, it is going to have this kind of unifying effect. You know, digital spaces are going to become the kind of town square of the 21st century, and the information superhighway would sort of take American democracy into a better place. And of course, the polar opposite has ended up being true.
You know, one of the things in this book that I really loved was your history of the idea of the American dream. So tell us a little bit about the history of the American dream.
Yeah, the American dream was first coined as a phrase in the 1930s, and it was coined by a historian called James Truslow Adams in a book that he called The Epic of America. I mean, curiously, his publisher actually rejected his preferred title, which was The American Dream. And the phrase was originally intended to describe a kind of new national credo, which rejected materialism. It rejected the materialism of the Gilded Age and the greed of the super wealthy robber barons. And what Adams was trying to do was to advance a kind of egalitarian ethos, the dream of a land, as he put it, in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone. And the idea of the American dream has been sort of distorted since then. It is more to do with personal success and personal improvement and an improvement in the living standards of your family and your kids. And originally, it was designed very much as a sort of collective credo that could bring the country together, rather than the kind of individualist belief that it has become now.
I just spoke with a fellow, Jeffrey Rosen, who wrote a book called The Pursuit of Happiness, where he tried to understand the meaning of that phrase in the Declaration of Independence and also just in general use at the time. And he traced it back not to an endless hedonistic party, but the idea that men of good virtue, taken from Greek philosophers, would be happier by virtue of leading a virtuous life. And we, of course, today have a very different interpretation. Talk about, you know, just the idea of, you know, the American exceptionalism, that we are, you know, the exception to all of the rules.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of American exceptionalism wasn't that strong around the time of the Constitution. The idea that sort of God had sort of blessed America, that it was uniquely special, that it was uniquely better. There wasn't really that sense around the time of the Constitution and the founding of the country. I mean, this was one of the more secular phases of American history. You know, there was that clear division between church and state that was set out in the Constitution. And the Founding Fathers didn't really believe that God was especially on their side. You know, in many ways, they regarded it as a kind of ungodly leap of faith rather than as something that was a godly sure bet. And the idea of American exceptionalism emerged over time, partly because of those early historians that I was talking about, partly because of this idea of manifest destiny taking hold, that it was preordained that America would take over the entire continent and it would be this flourishing, flourishing nation. But, you know, one of my arguments in the book, and it's a painful argument for me to make as somebody who loves America so much, is that, you know, when I was a kid, you know, the world, I think, had a really positive sense of American exceptionalism. America could do things that other countries simply couldn't. America could invent the future in a way that other countries just simply couldn't. And now, alas, you've got this sort of toxic sense of American exceptionalism. It's a country where bad stuff happens that other countries just don't want to emulate. Indeed, they want to inoculate themselves against the worst aspects of Americanization, which is, you know, gun violence, mass incarceration, you know, an opioid crisis that has taken hold in America in a way that hasn't taken hold in other countries, you know, a public health service that wasn't equipped to deal with a pandemic like COVID. And what's interesting is often how American exceptionalism denies the possibility that other countries can do it better. And that came again to the fore in COVID. I think, you know, an Americanism was deployed to cancel out the possibility that universal health coverage is a good thing. America would be a better country with it. And, you know, I think now you've got this sense of toxic American exceptionalism, where people look at the politics especially, you know, not as a beacon, but almost as a dumpster fire, a dumpster inferno. And they kind of look at America and think, we don't want to become like that. And that's the tragedy. And again, it's painful for somebody to say that as somebody who deeply loves America like me.
We're on the verge of another significant choice in the way direction America heads, whether, as you say, America invents a better future or America invents a better apocalypse. And I'd like you to talk about, you know, how you have seen, like, the way the campaign for Joe Biden has evolved and the campaign by Trump and now Kamala Harris. Where do you think that can go? Where do you think it will go?
Yeah, I mean, history is coming at us thick and fast at the moment, isn't it? You know, with the assassination attempt on Trump, the hoisting of the white flag from Joe Biden at his Rehoboth retreat after coming under so much friendly fire from his own party after that disastrous debate performance, and now the emergence of Kamala Harris. It's a stark choice. It was when Biden was up against Trump. I mean, it was easy to sort of characterize it as a kind of doddery old man against a crazy old man. You know, there wasn't much of a choice, but there was a stark choice. The choices between somebody who believes in democracy, Joe Biden, and somebody who doesn't believe in democracy. You know, we saw that on January the 6th when a sitting U.S. president tried to incite his own supporters to overturn what had been a clear-cut election. Even in 2016, when he won, he defamed democracy because he could not cope with the idea that Hillary Clinton had got more votes nationally than he did, 3 million more. He claimed that 5 million of those had been cast fraudulently, although no evidence obviously was ever found of that. So it is a stark choice. It looks even more stark now because it is personified in a different way. You've got this elderly man, Trump's got the age issue problem now, against a black woman of of South Asian heritage who's seeking to become the first female president. It's a stark choice visually and in personality terms, but it comes down to the same stark choice. One candidate who believes in democracy and another candidate who I believe would undermine democracy and possibly destroy it.
As a writer and a correspondent, I'd like you to talk about the import of, reporting, writing, reading, publishing, how that is important to the world and to America in these dark days.
Well, look, I don't think the media has had its finest hour since Donald Trump came down that golden escalator in Manhattan, a portal which many of his evangelical supporters regard as a stairway from heaven, proof that he was sent from God. And I think one of the strongest forms of bias in journalism is what's called a better story bias. It's where journalists love a story that has maximum journalist entertainment value. It's a story that comports with the kind of narrative which gives them the most thrills. And Donald Trump was that in 2016. It was an extraordinary story. And Donald Trump had these tools to bypass the media with Twitter and Facebook, but he really didn't need to because the media were obviously amplifying his message in a massive way. And I kind of worry about that now. I kind of think that there's a fascination, I think, with what a Trump second term would look like. Would it lead to the destruction of democracy? That's an extraordinary story. That's a better story, certainly, than a second term with Joe Biden, which would be a pretty somnolent thing to cover. And in some ways, that's what's good about the emergence of Kamala Harris. I think it sort of re-energized the reporting. There's an interesting story here. Could America have the first female president? Could they have the first female president of color? And so that becomes an interesting story, but it speaks of how, the storylines are shaped to a great degree by journalists, and often our better side, our better angels don't come out. We kind of promote the story that gives us the most entertainment value, as I say. And for so much of the Trump years, that has been the elevation of Donald Trump.
The new book by Nick Bryant is The Forever War. Thank you for joining me, Nick.
Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you for taking the book so seriously, and thank you for being so generous about it as well.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.